we trust. We're not sure about.
So episode 45 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. Joining me today, we've got a special guest, first and foremost, Lauren Malhoit. Welcome to the show again, Lauren.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nigel, and Mark and Gabe.
Woohoo! And that's our other two guys, yeah, Mark and Gabriel.
All right.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hey.
Nice and quiet this week.
Yeah, well done. It's almost like you're not here.
Oh, I know. It's funny because Mark was like, by the way, there are all kinds of great travel mics you can buy. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I would second that.
And here's the funny thing about that is, like, there are certain podcasts I've kind of, like, stopped listening to because the sound quality is so bad. And I'm like, God dang it. You know, I should probably eat my own dog food.
Man, that is hypocrisy at, like, the highest level. That, oh, dear. No worries, though, Gabriel. You bring good content. So, but a good travel mic would not go amiss.
There you go.
Agreed.
So does anybody have anything interesting going on that they want to talk about before we roll on into the tech news this week? Mark, you got anything happening on the beer front?
Well, yeah. Let's see. We bottled a batch of beer that I did. Let's see. It's one of the summer session beers. So it had been fermenting for about 3 weeks or so. We didn't put it in secondary fermentation, so the bottles are likely it's unfiltered, so there's going to be some schmutz at the bottom. So we'll have to pour it out. But the thing that we did a little different is we really amped up the priming sugar. So far, none of the bottle caps have come shooting off the bottles, but it should be highly carbonated. We'll see.
I thought you guys were told to stop talking about beer.
Well, who told us that? I mean, you can't stop talking about beer.
No,
yeah, we're going to have to wine week one of these days, but one of us will have to make wine to do it. So.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I've got something that's of potential interest to you guys, and I don't wish to stereotype you all by saying this, but I had a buddy come around today. So in our new house, we've got rabbits in the back garden, and like, I think the first time we had like one rabbit, and we gathered the kids around and we're looking out of the glass patio doors and like, oh, wow, look, we've got a rabbit in the garden. Now we've got 9 that are in there like nearly all day. So I had a buddy come around and brought around his air rifle, and he's going on holiday for 2 months. So he's loaned me his air rifle and I was doing a bit of target.
Nice. Practice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
they're
awesome.
So tasty.
It's only
they
like
really
a 0.22 caliber, right? So he said to me, you know, if you don't get a clean hit, you're probably not going to kill the rabbit straight away, and it's going to be screaming and squirming, and you might not want to do it again after that. And, I mean, I don't know, have you guys been hunting before? Because I've never been hunting before, and this is not like proper hunting, it's just me sitting or lying down in the back room at home and pointing a gun at a little rabbit, but...
Oh, I used to shoot birds all the time as a kid, duck hunting and pheasant hunting growing up in Minnesota, mostly pheasant hunting.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, in that case, you know, you use a shotgun, it sends out a pattern, and the thing is with an air rifle, and you can build them up to a fair amount of pressure, but you've got to have a pretty good hit. What's going to happen is you're going to have rabbits screaming all night long, and your children are going to be asking you, what's that horrible noise?
Can you hear the lambs crying, Clarice?
Exactly. It's the spring lambs, except it's going to be the summer rabbits at Nigel's. And, yeah, you can do it.
I mean, I tend to be of the mindset is if you're going to hunt for something, you should probably eat it.
Uh-huh.
You know? And some people have a taste for rabbit and others don't. But, you know, good clean hit. You know, you should be able to take a rabbit down, but, you know, be ready to go and do some hand-to-hand.
Oh, yeah, but Gabriel, it's a pellet gun. It's not even a 22.
Well, I mean, it's a 22 caliber pellet gun. I mean, and 177 is the other caliber that pellets come in, right? And if you look at pellets, they have different types. So they have copper and they have lead. I would suggest copper primarily because...
These are lead.
Yeah, because lead is going to... Well, I mean, if you want to eat the animals, I mean, you don't want to... It's like... You know, there's controversy over birdshot being lead and then, you know, lead transfer. So copper's not going to give you that particular issue. But
yeah, but the controversy isn't about eating lead. It's about just having it be in the environment, all that shot in the environment. I mean, shoot, feed it to your kids.
Yeah. So this friend of mine, he used to shoot for Cheshire. That's the county that I live in. So he's got a few rifles and things, and he's got, well, he called it a 12-bore shotgun. Does that mean anything to you guys?
12-gauge. Yeah. Oh,
12-gauge, okay, 12 gauge, right.
Yeah.
But he obviously, for legal reasons, he couldn't leave that with me. But he did say he might come around and let me have a pop with that. And I'm like, oh, my goodness.
As usual, us gun-toting Americans know all of the proper lingo and slang.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so you can...
Is that the stereotype you were assuming at the beginning,
yeah.
The Americans?
Yeah, because you guys, you all... I'm not saying you all do guns, but you all know guns and firearms and stuff. Like, I literally haven't got a clue. I have, an Olympic recurve bow. Like a member of an archery club, but that's as close to a weapon as I've got.
You should use the bow on the rabbits. That'll definitely take them down.
I know. I'm not sure that I'm quite that good with the bow, though. It's a bit harder. Yeah.
Well, you might find that your chances are as good with that as with the pellet gun. It depends on how close you can get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing is with that 12 gauge, that 12 bore, you can take them out at a pretty good range because that's a pretty good size weapon. You can shoot a rabbit at, oh, I don't know, my guess is 35 yards and probably get it.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it also depends on the shot you're using, too.
Absolutely, yeah. We should spend a show talking about...
Yeah, Fred Nixon. He's got some...
Does he? Yeah, he probably does.
Oh, yeah, he's got an arsenal.
I'm not an expert.
I did spend the show talking about it.
Yeah.
Hey, Lauren, do you do any shooting?
No. I don't like animals or anything except to eat them, but yeah, I don't know anything about guns. I know less than you, Nigel.
Oh, thanks. Good. I feel better.
The stereotype is shot.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Oh, well, not to worry. I shall report back next week, actually. Yeah. See how it goes. I know my oldest daughter, she's 9, and at first she was like horrified. What? Because they love the look of these rabbits. But like within 5 minutes, she's like, Dad, will you shoot that? Because I had my archery target out in the back. Will you show us how you shoot and stuff? And I'm like, go on then. And then she's like, can I have a shot? No. No, I barely know the weapon myself. So I will report back.
You should let her have a shot. How old is she?
She's 9.
You can do that.
I don't know if you have weapon safety training out there. I always recommend people go to that. That's one of the great things that the NRA does is provide all of that weapons training and proper usage. But it's all about caution and showing them respect for the weapon, regardless of the type, right? I mean, a pellet gun can be dangerous.
Sure, yeah.
Always know where the safety is. There's a safety. You always want it on until you're ready to pull the trigger, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, how you handle the gun and where the barrel is pointed at any time. That's a big deal, right? You don't swing the gun around so the barrel is going to like point at your wife's face ever or anything like that. The kids just have to know, you know, if they're walking to keep the barrel pointed down, you know, when they're getting ready to move, they're very careful handling the gun. So the barrel is always pointed away from people. The safety's always on. I mean, it's just common sense. You know, when people get plugged, it's usually because common sense flew out the window and something really stupid happened.
Yeah. You know, I think I will let her have a go. It's just today it was brand new to me and I just wasn't quite that confident. But from my time at the archery club, you know, I know all about that, pointing the weapon in the right direction. Nobody ever stands in front of the shooting line or anything like that. So we shall see.
Yeah. Have fun with it.
So tech news then.
Oh, God.
Report back on the first GSW.
I will do that. And, you know, assuming I don't get arrested for doing something ridiculous with it and I'm not here next week, but I think we should be good. Tech news then?
Let's go.
All right, then. I've got like 4 or 5 items, so I'll just run through them real quick. First up, Google joins the OpenStack Foundation at the corporate sponsor level. And I guess while that's not exactly like a platinum sponsor or anything, I am personally thinking this is... Well, it's got the potential to be huge for Google, I think. On a similar topic as well, sticking with Google, and I think related to this OpenStack move, but their open source container orchestration platform, Kubernetes, that went 1.0 this week or last week, I think. I've put this one under the tech news as well, just in case we have a tech discussion around it, one that's close to your heart, I think, Gabriel, but Cisco finally realized it couldn't make anything decent of its Invicta all-flash acquisition, so decided to put it to sleep. It took the shotgun to it, I think. There you go. Never mind, though. It only cost about $400 million, pennies to Cisco. Totally different story, though. Apparently, VMware vSAN surged through the 2,000 customer barrier, and I think that's double on what it was 6 months ago. We were talking about 1,000 customers. not so long ago here on the podcast. And sticking with VMware, word is they've got 700 paying NSX customers, which they seem to reckon, right, makes them the most widely deployed SDN vendor in the market. I mean, 700.
Tells you a little bit about the SDN market.
Exactly. I mean, I don't closely track it, but that doesn't seem like a big number to me.
No, the 2,000 for vSANs is a much bigger number, isn't it?
Yes, about it is, three times. Yeah. And also, I mean, that's pretty rapid growth. If it was just 1,000 customers 6 months ago, I know they went 2.0 or whatever version number they decided to give it, but it was effectively 2.0. And there were some decent upgrades that came with that for an enterprise customer. I was quite curious, though, Mark, since you're at a hybrid storage vendor, which I guess in some ways at least competes directly with vSAN. I'm just curious on the storage front what it's like, if you really know or can talk on this, competing with VMware in the storage space, because I guess they've got, like, you know, they've got a bunch of customers that are enterprise license customers and, you know, that are well entrenched with VMware already, and it seems like an easy sell for them almost to sell into this massive pool of existing customers. How do you deal with that in a competitive sense?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. For starters, we make hybrid storage, but we also make all flash. So we do both of those things, right? I just needed to correct you on that. But now, I'm not going to talk too much about Tejal stuff here, but right. I think those numbers, the 2,000 and 700, also tell a different story, and that is that it's easier for a customer to experiment and do one-off, you know, lab type of work things with vSAN than it is with SDN, NSX. There's an ease of experimentation, right? And so I think a lot of the vSAN numbers there are more experimental than, you know, we're running production workloads on them.
Well, and let's not forget some of these could be ELA numbers as well. So, you know, they bought the ELA and NSX and maybe vSAN are included in that as well.
Could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're not seeing a lot of that here. I don't know about anywhere else, but And I'm not sure that we would, though, right? I think that if somebody's doing that, they're probably not going to go out and look for, you know, an array to compete with their do-it-yourself kit. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. It'll be fun to see what is going on with it at VMworld next month. We'll be able to get a little bit better idea of what's going on with both these technologies, I'm sure. I mean, VMware will come out and they'll talk about it in glowing terms, but, you know, we'll talk to the V experts and find out what they're seeing and that kind of thing. That's the really great thing about VMworld is that, you know, you get to see a vision of where those guys are going, and then you get a level set also.
I wonder if part of these vSAN numbers include the Evo Rail product.
That's a good point, actually. And you know what? I didn't dig into that, so I don't have an answer to that.
I don't think anybody's ever seen an Evo Rail in the wild. I think that's one of those slowly going to slip under the cover mistakes.
Oh, do you think so?
Oh, yes.
Kind of like Invicta.
I don't know. At the Indie VMUG, they were advertising it on a few different banners I saw.
Yeah, I think that the actual adoption rate for something like the Evo Rail platform is fairly negligible. I mean, I haven't seen some of the vendors that were part of that big splashy announcement. Have you seen them really push it? Some of them, I think, have even bowed out of the platform because they didn't find any traction. And, of course, now you've seen all kinds of changes around the licensing for it because I think there were some mistakes that were realized in the beginning that they didn't quite fully understand. A, what the hyperconverged market really meant, B, what customers wanted in that space, and C, I mean, it ends up being a very expensive vSAN ready node.
Yeah.
And if I have vSAN ready node at 1/5 the cost or half the cost or whatever, do I really need the slick orchestration to deploy it? Not really, and because there were limitations from a technical standpoint of where it just didn't integrate with your existing VMware environments. So it was almost targeted exclusively to Greenfield and some very specialized corner use cases in customer environments.
You think that's going to affect Evo Rack and, you know, whether they'll release that?
Interesting enough, I mean, the Evo Rack discussion, I haven't seen a whole lot of information about what that entails too. And I think it's primarily because if you're going to tie it to NSX, then you're really going to have that product fully baked.
Right.
And not to say that it's not, but I also think if I start looking at SDN adoption rates in the target space for what an Evo Rack is, they're just not going to do it yet. I had several discussions this, you know, in the last week or so around SDN, and it's kind of one of those things where it's like we talk and pay a lot of lip service to it, but not a lot of people are actually doing it in production as much as they may want to.
Before we switch on to SDN, I remember like two, maybe 3 months ago now, we took the podcast to the London VMUG. And in the intro session at the beginning of the day, they did a show of hands. And there's like 150 people in the room or whatever. And bear in mind, all like diehard, loyal VMware customers, this is a VMUG event, right? And they did a show of hands around a bunch of things like how many people are using containers in production and how many people are using vSAN in production. And there were no hands up for containers. And, you know, scratching my memory, there maybe were a handful of hands up for vSAN. And then they asked about Evo Rail and there were no hands went up. Now, I appreciate that's like 2 or 3 months ago, but this is like the diehard VMware enthusiasts that are, you know, all congregating in London to talk VMware, and they obviously love it. And there at the time were nobody there that was using or even kicking the tires with Evo Rail, which I thought was quite telling. So I don't know, maybe you might be onto something there, Gabriel. That would be interesting if that got swept under the carpet. Oh dear. Oh,
it really points to really understanding the network, or, you know, the ecosystem and the customer base and what that group wants. I think part of Evo Rail was something that was done quickly to address a competitive space and a big gap that a lot of VMware partners had. And it was a means to sell a lot of, you know, advanced VMware licenses. You know, it's funny. Lauren and I are both at the Indie VMUG today, and I had this, you know, this tech talk session, just a 10-minute pop-up talk. There's probably 60 people in the audience watching it. And I just said, show of hands, how many of you using Storage I/O Control, which is an mm-hmm. Enterprise Plus feature? And three hands went up. And then I'm like, well, how many of you have Enterprise Plus licenses? And four hands went up. And that goes to show, in some respects, I mean, and this is a VMUG. This is one of the biggest ones they have. 900 people show up to this thing. Enterprise Plus licensing, in certain respects, just is a non-starter gate based on its cost. And people will find other ways to work around, you know, some of the offerings that come in those advanced features. And Evo Rail was an Enterprise Plus full kit and caboodle top tier licensing product. And at, you know, list price anywhere from 160 to 250K for a platform that supported roughly 100 machines, that's very expensive.
Yeah, and doesn't fit in with your current environment too.
And didn't have any of the rich, yeah, it had a lot, deficient in terms of the rich services that Nutanix or Simplicity offer on top around, you know, orchestration and scalability and backup and disaster recovery and all those other things. Granted, you could buy all those other things as VMware products and add them on, but now you've just jacked your cost up another 2x.
And you still only have one hypervisor to work with as opposed to the other players.
Right. Not the strongest foray into the market.
Let's see what comes in VMworld then. Talking, though, about the SDN world, I guess that's something that you're pretty hot on, Lauren. You're still doing ACI, yeah?
Yep, that is my main focus. So take everything I say about NSX with a grain of salt.
Of course, yeah. But the SDN market just in general, right? Give us the state of the play there from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, seeing VMware's numbers, the NSX at 700, again, you know, I don't know how many of those are true production environments or how many of them are even being used. It could just be an ELA purchase, but those numbers are about right. You know, we haven't announced our numbers for Q4 yet, so I don't know what they are currently. I think we were above 500 last time they were announced a few months ago. And I think NSX and ACI are probably the two leaders right now. You know, at least it's what I hear about all the time. So yeah, those numbers look a lot about right. You know, people are testing it out. We do have production environments certainly, and some big companies that are running it in production already all over the world. But it's, you know, people are scared of it. It's a brand new brave new world out there.
Are the challenges in the SDN space similar to those that OpenStack faces around complexity, the fact that it's not massively mature at the moment, and maybe the effort and the technical skill set required to deploy it are quite high? Is that accurate or is that like totally wrong?
I think a few months ago that was accurate. I'm not sure. For NSX, I don't think it's gotten much simpler to deploy unless there's something I don't know about since the last time I worked with it. ACI is certainly working on doing things like a vCenter plugin, which they demoed at a Cisco Live, which, I mean, is just as simple as can be. So that even brings in our VMware admins to be able to use it and literally manage, you know, networking for virtual and physical workloads. We have things like ACI Toolkit, which kind of simplifies it. We even have a different GUI now that I forget what we call it, but it's some sort of simple GUI. So yeah, I mean, there were some complexities there that definitely, I think, for all of the SDN vendors out there, you know, it's hard to create this product and, you know, you want to keep your user in mind, but you want it to be able to do all of these great things too. But it's a little different than OpenStack, right? Because it's not, you know, several disparate people and companies contributing to it, and there's one support, you know, place to go. So it's a little different as far as complexities go, and we are working diligently on correcting that.
No doubt. So is it difficult to sell to customers what the advantages of SDN are? You know, what is a customer going to get out of it? Or do customers tend to, or do they grasp what they're going to get from deploying SDN technologies in their environment, but feel that it's just early and it's maybe a little bit hard to do at the moment? Or are you still in the stage of where you're really trying to convince people that it's worthwhile?
No, I think the customers that actually need SDN are already convinced of what it can do for them. You know, they're the ones that need that kind of automation and policy-driven control and all of that good stuff. And they've needed it for a while. It's kind of the smaller shops that don't totally understand that maybe would be good customers for it, but they're not quite wrapping their heads around it yet. So there's a little bit of that, a little bit of convincing, but definitely I think the larger customers that truly do need the SDN solution are totally convinced. It's just a matter of when they're going to do it, how they're going to do it. You know, they're not going to change their entire core networking over to ACI in a night, you know, or NSX. They're going to start with, you know, one pod or one new application that they need to bring up, something like that. So, you know, I think it's a slow and steady kind of rise, I think, is what it's going to be.
Hey, one last question maybe thrown at you, Lauren. So is it like a totally awesome and cool technology to be working with? You know, you said before we started recording the podcast, you've just come back from a family vacation. Are you like chomping at the bit to get back and like totally excited to, you know, it's like, oh, I'm so glad the holiday wasn't any longer because I really want to get back to work and get working on this totally awesome face melting stuff, or is it not like that?
No, it is. It's really awesome. I mean, it's overwhelming sometimes. I mean, we have brown bags every week just to talk about the new thing that's happening this week or today in, you know, ACI. So it's like, you know, I've been there a little over a year now, and it's still all just new to me. I'm constantly drinking from a fire hose, which, you know, is a little overwhelming sometimes too, but it keeps it exciting. Whereas, you know, you find yourself in other roles sometimes getting bored with doing the same things over and over again. So it's definitely exciting. And my boss keeps me moving on different types of things. So yeah, I'm always happy to be doing what I'm doing.
Yo, Gabriel, you had a crap role in your previous role when you were at Cisco, didn't you? And you bailed.
Which I willfully took.
Yeah, but you bailed just in time. So we said earlier, Cisco have decided that the Whiptail acquisition, the Invicta Technologies, for whatever reason, right, just wasn't going to work, I guess, and they've put it to sleep. And I'm kind of, I'm looking forward to your opinion on this and maybe Mark's as well, because, you know, you're all involved in flash storage and things like that. I can't wrap my head around how Cisco couldn't make it work, or, I mean, was it really that bad? Because surely Cisco want to be in this market, and not having this in their product portfolio has got to be like a gaping hole, in my opinion, right?
Well, I mean, A, there's only so much I can talk about. B, it's rumors at this point.
Yes, of course. I should have said that, yeah.
So, you know, so until, like, you know, it officially gets announced, and of course, obviously I read the article on the Register today and everybody's like, no comment, and that's expected. You know, I think that the team that was involved with the Invicta acquisition, or at least at the leadership level. Paul Perez is part of, head of data center group inside Cisco. I mean, he's left Cisco since then. And I think, part of it is that if you have somebody who champions a product and brings it in, and then it doesn't quite it doesn't quite work as expected, and then they leave rapidly or under a cloud or whatever, whoever's next in line, they don't necessarily want to have that baggage around. So maybe it's easier to approach it from that standpoint than it is to say that, it was a product that could not work, right? There were definitely Invicta customers or Whiptail customers before the company was purchased. And there were customers who bought it while it was part of Cisco. I think the technology itself...
Really? Like, how long did Cisco have it on sale for?
Well, they got it in 2013. I think they were still trying to sell that. Even keep in mind, there was a transition period where they were moving off of a platform that was based on a white box vendor,
yeah,
and onto Cisco hardware, which is a qualification effort. I mean, it has to happen, right? And you have to make sure that all of those, all the I's are crossed and the T's are dotted. And in doing so, sometimes you find things that are a challenge. And then, if you're trying to update code base, or if you're trying to add features or remove features, then you find issues there. And I think they bit off a little bit more than they chew. And to be frank, I don't think that I know there are a lot of really sharp people inside Cisco that understand storage, but they don't have a storage business unit, right? There's not like there, you have the data center group, you have the networking route switch people, you have security, you have wireless and all these others, but there's no dedicated group that has the same visibility with inside Cisco for storage. And, primarily the reason behind that is that they have partnerships with a lot of people. They are kind of a Switzerland, right?
Oh, yeah.
They have Nimble, they have Pure, they have, SolidFire, they have all the different array manufacturers have solutions that they can partner with Cisco. And if I'm Cisco,
like
if I'm Cisco, I look at this and go, well, I don't have to sell, I don't have to just carve out one niche. I have the compute, I have the route switch, I have the security, I have all these other solutions that I can focus on selling and leave the storage up to somebody else. And yes, we're not capturing that part of the business, but the diversity of offering is so much larger than anything else that's on the market. So if I go buy a storage solution, I'm going to want to push that first. And yeah, there's business to capture there. But could it come at the expense of some of the other solutions if there's gaps, right? If it doesn't have an NFS solution portion, if it doesn't have the ability to scale out, if it doesn't have a rich, support ecosystem and strong, really strong offering in the space, or hit a market you really want to go after and penetrate. And you can have those things coexist with other things. I think they tried to do that, try to have their cake and eat it too by saying, well, this is application acceleration in the compute environment, this is in storage. And really, nobody bought that message.
No, everybody saw through that.
So, Nigel, let me turn the tables on you. What if I asked you if you would be surprised, or what would your expectation be for Microsoft buying StorSimple? Microsoft's a big company; they've got a lot of business in data centers. What would you expect that StorSimple business to be?
Well, I'm not sure I understand what you mean there. What do you mean? What would I expect it to be?
Well, you asked the question about Invicta and Cisco. It's like, so what went wrong or what's there? I think, yeah, actually there are more ways for things to go wrong than to have them go right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's an interesting thing. It's getting a lot of the news. The StorSimple thing will probably never get any news. But, that's falling apart inside Microsoft.
Uh-huh.
Right. That business is not doing very well. And I think a lot of people would look at that and say, well, that's not so surprising. Right. And yet at the same time, you look at Invicta and Cisco and you say, well, that's kind of surprising. How did they screw it up?
Yeah.
The point I'm trying to make is it's a lot harder than it looks. And a lot of the points that Gabriel makes, if a company doesn't have DNA to be in an industry, if they don't really have expertise to, if they're really not prepared to have those conversations with customers and make sense out of them, it's not going to be successful.
Right. I'm with you. I think the difference in my head with Microsoft versus Cisco would be the fact that the way I see it, Cisco are like a data center hardware type company. They've got the routing and the switching. They've got the compute platform now. It almost seems like it's a natural gap in their product portfolio there to not have the entire stack. Whereas Microsoft...
Yeah, I understand that line of thinking. It definitely makes sense. But, you know, also it's a lot more complex when you have relationships like BCE. When you have...
Is that still a relationship?
I mean, they still own 10% of it. Oh. You know, I mean, that's no small shakes. That's 10%. That way it's more money than Invicta makes.
Oh, yeah, true.
Right? And they don't have to really push that hard to sell. But, I mean, you know, you have relationships with the storage manufacturers. Think about this. You know, you still have MDS, fiber channel switching, and an entire ecosystem around original storage manufacturers who bring that to market. And there's follow-on business associated and attached to that. And, you know, let's say that the market for that and all of the switching components in terms of connectivity for storage is, say, let's give it a magic number of $1 billion. Do you want to jeopardize that for something that may sell $50 to $200 million if you're really lucky in 1 year, right? Yeah. You're going to give up that consistent run rate that's very high margin. No. It's, you know, there's, trust me, I think Cisco has some really, they do have a lot of really smart people, and they probably have some smart data scientists / economists that ran the numbers. Nothing was just made. This wasn't like a willy-nilly discussion or decision. This wasn't because they didn't like the people or the product or anything like that. It's a financial decision. And it's a strategy that needs to come to bear. And I think what you're seeing is the shaking out of some of the legacy decisions and things that were done under John Chambers. And you're seeing Chuck Robbins come in and start to make his he wants kind of a clean slate and no baggage. Yeah. I mean, Invicta
I don't really buy that it was clear cold logic. There was a jilt factor there, the EMC jilt factor there. I think they acted rashly, more than they normally would. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
Hey Mark, so are you sweating on it now that that there's the potential that Cisco could acquire Tegile? Because, I mean, you've done Dell, you've done HP, you've done Microsoft. You need to finish that round and get Cisco under your belt and have like a nightmare year with another Goliath of a company there. But seriously, though, do we expect that Cisco will go out now and pick up Nimble or Tegile or somebody like that? Or are they going to say, hey, we burned ourselves there, hands off, we'll just go with the plethora of partners that we've got, like you said, Gabriel, you know, they do partner and have reference architectures with every single storage company under the sun, right? What do we expect?
That's a good question. I don't know why they would buy anyone when they can partner. They get to be Switzerland. They can sell with everyone, you know, and I think that that really helps their server business. Why would they want to scuttle that? I don't know.
Yeah, would you absolutely die and go and hide under a rock for 6 months if they did acquire Tegile?
You know, that's an interesting... It depends on how much stock I was trying to invest in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Probably. I'd probably find a rock.
All right. So the other item of news, which we're not going to give a lot of time to because I think next week we're going to have Ken Hoy on. But the Google thing with OpenStack and with Kubernetes going 1.0, which actually is kind of I thought was kind of interesting because I'm just used to Google projects being like in beta for 10 years. And then suddenly going like GA or whatever after, you know, I've been using them for pretty much everyday life. Anyway, so I think last week, was it, we talked about they plugged the gap in their Google Cloud platform where they previously didn't have Windows Server as an offering. So they've now got Windows Server, right? They're not like a platinum or a gold sponsor at OpenStack, but they're going to be potentially heavily involved with OpenStack. And Kubernetes goes 1.0. Kubernetes is, you know, in there with OpenStack and what have you. I'm just thinking those three things there. Windows Server getting on the OpenStack Foundation board and Kubernetes becoming a production-worthy product is, you know, does that say big things for Google going forward? Are they getting their ducks lined up in a row to make a real assault on the enterprise? And I know we've kind of rolled our eyes at Google and their inability to compete in the enterprise, but do they have the beginnings of a good story here, do we think?
My first thought is they're kind of a little late to the game on the OpenStack sponsorship.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I wonder if they will eventually worm their way to become like a gold or a platinum sponsor. I'm not exactly sure how that works. I think there's like platinum sponsors. Is that where there's like a limit to like 13 companies or something like that that get voted in? I don't know. Do you know that, Gabriel?
I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but you know, there is some aspect of it where I don't think seats are guaranteed. You still have to be voted in.
Uh-huh.
But I think it helps with drive of direction for sure.
And you know what? Kubernetes being like a container orchestration platform that can potentially sit there and bridge the gap between on-prem and private clouds and public clouds and what have you. An OpenStack, you know, really does need to get a bit better at being not container-centric, but it needs to have a better story with containers. And I guess Kubernetes could become really fundamental to OpenStack going forward, which could see Google move to be a gold or a platinum sponsor in the future. But I'm just thinking, right, that, you know, they've had a sorry story when it comes to enterprises in the past. And it does seem that OpenStack is the only option for enterprises when it comes to hybrid cloud. And if Kubernetes can get in there and be like that kind of container orchestration platform where you can, say, take container-based workloads from an on-prem OpenStack private cloud and then move them to Azure or Google Cloud Platform, not AWS. Of course, they don't play with Kubernetes. But that could position Google pretty well, in my opinion. And I don't know, is it not so long before we'll be saying, yeah, Google got a pretty good story in the enterprise space?
I agree with you, Nigel. I think it depends on how strategic this is within Google, right? Who's doing it? How much backing do they have? You know, to Sergey and Bryn Kaer, if that's the case, and this really is a serious direction for Google, they're doing the right thing. If it's just, you know, somebody that's, you know, passing through Google on their way somewhere else, then it'll be like a lot of other stuff they've tried and failed at in the enterprise.
Yeah. Because I think in the enterprise space and the hybrid cloud space, Microsoft really doesn't seem to have a strong competitor there, because Amazon Web Services is very, very much, you know, 100% public cloud, don't care about OpenStack, on-prem or hybrid or anything like that. Microsoft have really got the lead there. I wonder if Google think. Go on, Google.
I think you'll see that change. I think you'll see all of the majorly public cloud providers having some kind of pivot to hybrid. And in the container space, I mean, we get hung up on certain aspects, but the reality is whoever comes through with the most, you know, easy and efficient to use container management platform is ultimately going to be who wins out. You know, that's the space that people are vying for right now. It's not the container technology itself. It's how do we manage it? How do we make it approachable to the vast swath of companies we think it is? Because right now, I guarantee you, you know, it's like not even 1%. Yeah. It is such a nascent space. And it's great for internal dev teams and things like that. But, I mean, I think that you would be hard-pressed to count on your fingers and toes the number of, you know, legitimately large enterprise customers that are using containers for the true intent purposes that they were designed around for the bulk of their production workloads.
Well, Gabriel, do you think that Google's using Kubernetes primarily for internal development work then? I mean, is this just something that they're interested in to help build their own tech?
I could spend the rest of my life trying to guess what Google's trying to do and be wrong every time. So many things, it's like almost like they do it on a whim. I mean, obviously, Kubernetes is something they use internally because it's got great value to them. They've used it for a long time, and it's part and parcel to their delivery model as a company. Now, exposing that out to others and selling that to other organizations who don't have that same kind of business model, that will be interesting to see. And if they're going to try to leverage it and use it to, you know, to bridge the gap between, you know, some kind of hybrid on-premises and in the public cloud container management platform, I mean, I think that's one area that they could definitely go forward with.
I just toasted a V Brown bag with can't remember his name, but it was all Kubernetes, the Google Cloud Platform series on V Brownbag. And he does talk about what they use Kubernetes for. And of course, you know, I was the host, so I was barely paying attention. But
oh, jeez.
But if only I could remember what he said. But he did, I believe, have an answer to that.
Well, you know, I think, Mark, to answer your question, what are Google trying to do with Kubernetes and is it just for internal development? For me, right, looking at it from the outside, the fact that it's gone 1.0 so soon after being released as open source to the market suggests to me that they're not just looking to throw this out there into the community and let the community collaborate with them on it, and then deploy that kind of tech internally, because we all know they kind of use it internally already. The fact that they've pushed it 1.0, so made it look kind of enterprise ready, general availability, that kind of thing, suggests to me at least that it's not just for them to take from the community and use internally. I really think that they look at OpenStack as potentially the only viable enterprise grade private / hybrid cloud platform. And if they shoe Kubernetes in as the orchestration tool for OpenStack, you know, under the codename Magnum or whatever it is, I think that's their ultimate goal. But you know what? I'm sure Ken next week is going to have some great insights on this.
Yeah. Next week. All right.
Next week.
I won't be on next week. I'm going to miss it. I'll be fishing in Montana.
Oh, nice. Okay. Be sure to listen to it then.
Not hunting. I won't have guns.
Okay, well, let's pivot on to business news. So, leading out with Google again, apparently last week their market cap hit like a mahoosive $66.9 billion. That seems quite a lot to me. But a company having a far worse time of it, IBM suffered its 13th, that's 1-3, straight quarter of declining revenues. And like the last three of those, well, at least on the chart I looked at, looked particularly bad. Simplivity seemed to be barreling towards a 2016 IPO. Looks like Daron's seizing control is now king of sales at the company, as well as a bunch of other things. And EMC, they posted pretty decent results, including decent growth of Extreme IO, so greater than 300% growth on the Extreme IO front, though not sure that we're certain how many of those were actually sold and paid for. But that's the business news for the week. Now, I've got a question, right, around IBM. They're a huge old company, right, and they've been around for forever. And who knows, they probably will be around for forever. You know, mainframes are going to be core to a lot of companies for a very, very long time going forward. But 13 straight quarters of declining revenues, and apparently some of these have been worse than at the height of the financial crisis. I mean, how long can even a company of IBM's size and stature roll with something like this?
I mean, they've been in this transitional phase for quite some time. Oh, they kind of forever. Start to shed their, I mean, at some point pretty soon, outside of mainframe, that's the only business machine they'll be selling. They've shed the hardware side of the business. I wouldn't be surprised to see the storage aspect, the storage assets sell at some point, probably to Lenovo when they've decided they can scratch up a bit of cash to buy it. I mean, you know, I would expect all the common things. I mean, from a company with 100,000 people in their charge, you know, more reductions in force, more shedding of non-profitable business units, more streamlining, and a shift of focus to some other areas. But to see that downward trend and to see it fairly starkly continuing to point deeper and deeper downward every quarter is got to be distressing to the board as well as their investors. And I would be very not surprised to see some kind of investor lawsuits pop up here fairly soon.
Hey, but Gabriel, so you say they've been divesting some of the business units that are not making profit, right? So which business units within IBM are going to be the big hitters going forward? I mean, we know, right, that the mainframe is going to be around forever, but I dare say it's probably not a big hitter, as in it's going to be incremental over the next 10, 15, 20, 10,000 years, whatever, right? But I look at the kind of things that they're trying to get in. So, you know, they're investing in OpenStack and the cloud. They're investing in big data, in mobile, all that kind of stuff. But are any of those really going to be big hitters for them in the future? I'm not convinced that they are.
Well, and what about services? I mean, that's pretty big there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where all the money's at.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe services is going to be a good one for them. But I just looked at it. I was like, you know, they got shot of the x86 business unit. And when you look at the rest of their portfolio, I could be wrong about this, right? But how many people actually look at IBM and say, you know what, they are best of breed in this or in that outside of mainframe, okay, right? I just think a lot of companies would buy IBM because, you know what, they've bought their servers for a while and they're already on the list of approved suppliers and they've got relationships and stuff like that. But now that they don't have that x86 business unit, you know, they I was going to I almost said that they sold their chip fab unit as well, but they didn't quite sell that really. But are they now in a position where they're not really best of breed anywhere? And why would you go to them if you're not already buying their x86 servers? And I don't know, it looks pretty stark.
In my professional career, I've never seen any piece of IBM equipment.
Are you serious?
I mean, whoa. I'm fairly young, but I've been in the business for a dozen years, and I've not once. And I was a partner, you know, I went to several different data centers.
Wow. Okay. There you go. You know what? You may never see any of their kit. They may be gone in a couple of years. Now, I'm sure they won't be, but I don't know. It's difficult times for those guys, it seems.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard for the largest companies. You know, this transition to cloud, this transition to mobile is, and in storage, the transition to flash is really taking people out. And so much change going on, right? And these companies, you know, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, right? It's the idea of like turning a big ship and trying to get the employees on board and trying to, you know, get the customers understanding this change. There's so much invested in the old stuff, it's really hard for them to go to the new. So IBM's, you know, trying to make a big deal out of the smarter planet. And I think they probably do have a considerable amount of expertise around analytics. I think actually, you know, if you looked at any one company out there, IBM probably has the most talent around analytics, and they better figure out how to get money for that and how to apply it.
The analytics doesn't that kind of, I mean, it could tie into their services organization as well.
Absolutely, Lauren. Yeah, that's a service business. I don't think it's that much of a software business. I think it's a service business. I think there will be a lot of services there. Who knows? The analytics business is in its infancy also. You know, Gabriel was talking about, you know, we're 1% of our way, you know, and I can't remember which business we're in. Well, analytics is probably not even that far along.
Do you think that's going to be huge going forward?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Well, and does that tie into big data then too?
Well, it is. It is big data, right? It is.
Right.
It's having all of this stuff and then trying to figure out, you know, what to do with it. We've never had
how to make it information.
Yeah. So we've gone, you know, you kind of look at it from this big picture. You know, we had the industrial age, you know, where we, you know, the information age. You could say, well, we're really just starting because we haven't done much scrubbing of all this information, and now we're getting the equipment, you know, to get there. We're getting software and, you know, we're getting the systems that are big enough and fast enough. We're getting memories, we're getting storage, you know, we're getting networks that have the capability of really, you know, it's like you can do high performance computing now with, you know, with stuff that's affordable. Everybody can get it. Everybody's going to be doing it. And we haven't seen what the results are. And if the results turn out to not be good, IBM is fucked. That's all there is to it.
Say it as it is. Hey, on the Simplivity front then, do we think an IPO next year would be a good thing for Simplivity? Is that their exit? Is that what they're looking for?
I mean, I think everybody's looking for an exit. I mean, I think that there's others in line before them. I mean, primarily Nutanix and Pure are the two that come to forefront of mind for almost everybody in the space. We're looking for possible unicorns to make the IPO push. You know, private money is cheap. At some point, you do have to start paying it back, though. I think maybe you have a little more leeway than most people expect. To me, it's an interesting move to see somebody like Mitch Breen, who was 27 years at EMC, made a brief pit stop at Oracle, and then came over to Simplivity and was there for a little bit, I think a year or more. And that's somebody with some significant sales, you know, experience and history for a certain type of market segment. Having the CEO take over sales on top of CEO duties seems odd to me. And, you know, I've not seen many organizations where, you know, the head of worldwide sales is also the CEO.
It's not entirely unexpected with Daron being Daron, though, really, is it?
That's very true. Daron likes to have and exert his level of control over the organization. And, you know, you read some of the titles of articles written about him, you know, execution machine. You know, I mean, he's all about execution. He's got a lot of internal processes that he's built and crafted from the ground up himself and that he's inactive with inside those organizations. And, you know, it's been successful for him in the past. It remains to be seen if it's going to be successful with an IPO or an acquisition exit for Simplivity. You know, from everything that I've heard from both people I know at Simplivity and Nutanix, both companies are doing fairly well and selling into, you know, a broader market space. The thing that I question about hyperconverged as a whole is now that we've had half a dozen other players come in there and clutter the market and kind of, you know, adjust some of the messaging, is what is the real total addressable market that they can truly approach and continue to generate new customers, new logos, and net new business that gets them to the point where they're, you know, they're legitimately long-term viable. And I think, you know, if you look at hyperconverged as a whole, I still think it is very much a remote office, branch office, and smaller play, despite of all of the messaging around, you know, hyperscale, web scale, et cetera. You know, because the cost dynamics are just so not there. It breaks down fairly rapidly after, you know, 15 nodes, 16 nodes. And then as the environments get more complex, what you have to, then, you know, the value prop of the scalability aspects start to diminish. You know, it's a simple man's data center tool. It's not a very sophisticated data center tool.
Do you think IPO is the most viable exit strategy for Simplivity?
I think both them and Nutanix have significant, you know, sufficient run rate to get there. Right. It's a matter of who you've aligned, who you've partnered with to do the IPO and bring it forward. I mean, I think we've heard articles, we've read articles that, you know, Nutanix is in active with Goldman or somebody like that to start the process. I haven't heard anything about that when it comes to Simplivity. You know, let's look back at a couple of the Fusion.io and Nimble and Violin. And out of the three there, Nimble is really the only one that people would actually want to probably buy in terms of it being a stock. Fusion.io, you can't. And Violin is
playing its own sad song.
They're playing their song on the all-flash Violin that they have. I mean, that's not to crack on them too hard. But, you know, it's IPOs is a tricky thing. It's hard to do if you've never done it before. I've never done it before. Mark's got more experience with exit strategies than all of us. But, you know, at some point, I think your investors do want to get paid.
At some point, they want their money. I don't know. To me, that's a real red flag to have the CEO come in and take out a guy like Breen who has this much experience. And how long have you been there doing that job? A couple of years?
You know, Mitch came on, so he's probably over a year.
Over a year. Okay. What the hell is that? Right. You bring in somebody. It's like, why is he gone and not replaced with somebody else from sales? You know, you already brought someone in because your CEO probably couldn't get the job done. Did he learn that much from the guy that they're getting rid of? You know, that's probably not right. I mean, what the hell is that? What makes Doran such a great sales guy? I mean, what the hell is that? Right. Maybe it's because
I would agree. I think it is somewhat of a red flag, or maybe it's a flag to denote that the acquisition is coming. You know, I just don't know.
Well, there's could be that. Holy cow. Yeah, let's see. We're going to get acquired. So let's see. You'll get paid off a little less if we fire you. Oh, my gosh.
I don't know if it's fired or, you know, I mean, like I said, I have no inside knowledge on that. But it just some, you know, the articles that I read about it weren't super favorable of it either.
He's pursuing other interests and apparently still has stock in the company. So,
you know, that's every politician that leaves.
Yeah.
Spending more time with my family.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I have a model railroad set that I like to work on.
Yeah, he's got his future compensation, you know, and, you know, for hush up, you know, something doesn't smell right there.
And on that note, shall we slide out for the week?
Sounds good.
Always a smelly business.
Yeah.
It is. Smelly business.